read from a roster. Mike Atterbury, Jeff Glenn, John Henneberry, Dale Otta, Dean Otta. When McLeod finished, he'd read 14 names. He looked up at the boys. Is there anyone whose name I didn't call? In the back, against the wall, Brad Rausch raised his hand. McLeod frowned, then looked down at the paper in his hands. He walked over to Sweet, and they had a brief discussion in the hallway. After a moment, the two men returned, McLeod looking serious and Sweet angry. Then McLeod announced that he had bad news. Mr. Rausch was not on the official postseason roster that Macon had sent in to the Illinois High School Association prior to the playoffs. He had to report this. Henneberry waited for McLeod to smile. It had to be a joke, right? Instead, the principal dismissed the boys. Then McLeod called Hal Pritchard, the athletic director at Stephen Decatur, who in turn called the Illinois High School Association, IHSA. 2 hours later, the IHSA called back with its decision. Since Rausch's name hadn't been submitted prior to the playoffs, Macon had won with an ineligible player. The school had to forfeit its victories and exit the tournament. Stewardson Strasburg, the team Ironmen had just beat, would face Stephen Decatur in the regional finals that afternoon. Sweet gathered the boys and broke the news. He knew it was his role to be diplomatic, to take the school line, but he couldn't help himself. This, he said, is absolute horseshit. Doug Tomlinson felt like he got hit by a truck. Henneberry was stunned into silence. Schartzer flew into a rage, demanding answers. It was one thing to lose a game, but disqualified? It wasn't like Brad Rausch was some ringer who had just moved to the district. He was a senior honor student who had played baseball his first 3 years at Macon High. How the hell could a kid like that be ineligible? Sweet felt disgusted and betrayed. He knew he'd updated the roster and filed it. What he didn't know was where along the bureaucratic ladder the roster had stalled. Whether it was with Phil Sargent, the school's well-meaning athletic director, or perhaps at another administrator's office. He couldn't help but wonder about the timing. Why would McLeod decide to recheck a logistical item on this, the morning of the team's biggest game, then report it himself? Sweet was pretty sure he knew why. Sweet felt the worst for the seniors. That evening, he drove to Doug Tomlinson's house near Elwyn. For 2 hours, he, Doug, and Doug's parents sat in the kitchen commiserating. Sweet told them how sorry he was. He felt like it was his fault. How he felt powerless. All of them were angry, but none knew how to channel that anger. When they'd said all they could, Sweet took his leave. Meanwhile, across town at the Jesse house, Jeannie was standing in the kitchen with her mother when one of her sisters came running into the house, crying. It was Luann, who was dating Schartzer at the time.
The team's been disqualified, she sobbed, then sprinted upstairs to her bedroom.
Jeannie's heart sank. A couple hours later, she heard the throbbing of a motorcycle engine outside the house. Jeannie walked out into the night to see Sweet on his Triumph Bonneville, looking strangely vacant-eyed. Want to go to Decatur? He asked. I need to get out of here. It was the first time Sweet had invited Jeannie to his place in Decatur. She knew he must be taking it hard. They roared through the darkness, past the silhouette of cornfields, until they reached Decatur and the small, run-down house where Sweet was renting a room. He dropped his stuff and then slumped into a chair. There, he told her what had happened, how McLeod had delivered the news, how crushed the boys had looked. Jeannie remembers Sweet as reeling and inconsolable. She suggested they go see the Schartzers or the Glans. Maybe getting the team together would make him feel better. He said he couldn't bear to. She suggested going to a bar, But that held no allure either. So there they sat. No music, no drinks. Sweet was the most joyful, lively person she knew. Now, it was like the light had been drained right out of him. What was there to do? In the days that followed, the parents held an emergency meeting in the cafeteria at school, then urged Sweet to help them find a culprit. They wanted to take their case to the board. They wanted to bring down McClard or Sargent. Sweet declined the parents' entreaties. It wouldn't change things, he said. They still wouldn't get a chance to play Decatur. Still, the disqualification gnawed at him. The following week, he descended to the equipment room in the basement to organize all the gear and file an end-of-the-year inventory. Only instead of doing so, he dumped everything in a pile and left it there. Then, when he saw the players that afternoon, he told them to keep their uniforms. The school didn't deserve them back anyway. Besides, if McClard was suddenly so interested in the team, let him buy new ones. Sweet knew this wouldn't go over well, but he didn't care. He was too angry, not just for himself, but for the boys. He'd watched them come together and seen their pride in the team and the confidence they'd gained. Usually, he felt there were important lessons that came from losing. He didn't see much of a lesson here. 9. Long summer nights. Sweet needed to get out of Macon. After graduation, he headed to Champaign and got a job painting houses with two buddies, a world away from small-town politics. Some nights, he jumped on his Triumph and cruised the 50-some miles to Eastern Illinois University in Charleston, where Jeannie was living in the Delta Zeta sorority house. In the hope of graduating early, she'd petitioned the school to take 20 hours of summer classes. When Sweet visited, the couple spent evenings driving around the country, he cracking jokes and she giggling. At the end of each night, she walked into the sorority house and he climbed to the top of it, ascending the fire escape to the flat tar roof. There, on a wool blanket, he lay down under a canopy of stars, marveling at the new turn his life had taken. As Sweet was busy clearing his head and falling in love, the Iron Men players were spending their summer trying not to dwell on the disqualification. For those who remained, an unspoken pact was formed. To get better, to play tighter, to return to the postseason and advance to sectionals the following season. In the thick Illinois heat, the returning players gathered for impromptu games at the old elementary school just north of the Macon Library. Brian Snitker rolled up on his bike, and Henneberry walked from his parents' place on Front Street. The Ottas arrived in Dale's midnight blue 1964 Chevy Impala, the one with the bucket seats Dale was so proud of. Some days they played over the line. Other times it was home run derby or a full-fledged scrimmage. If only two boys showed up, the pair took turns hitting balls against the brick facade of the high school, the crack of the bat followed by the thud of ball on mortar. At night, the boys cruised out to Mile Corner, listening to Led Zeppelin. Gas was 30 cents a gallon, and nobody ever put in more than a dollar's worth at a time. For a dollar was a lot to the boys back then, and few had more than two or three in his pocket at any given time. So a trip to Decatur was only for special occasions. Other times they'd sit at the country manor and tell lies. Each night, it seemed, a different parent hosted dinner. One evening you could have shown up at the Schartzer's house and found three sweaty kids scarfing down chili and dumplings. The next, the house was empty because they'd all be over at the Snitker place, eating chicken. Of all the boys, though, Schartzer and Henneberry bonded the most that summer. As the two returning pitchers, they knew they would form the team's backbone in 1971. But it went beyond that. John was an only child, and Schartzer had only an older sister. In each other, they'd found something of the brother they'd never had. Sports formed the foundation of their friendship, but they rarely discussed them. Instead, once a week or so during the summer, the duo borrowed either Bob Schartzer's cream-colored Ford Fairlane 500 or Jack Henneberry's white Ford Fairlane and drove to the southeast leg of Lake Decatur, a sprawling man-made lake 20 minutes from Macon. There, on grassy banks thick with shrubs and shadowed by sycamore trees, they set their fishing lines with crawdads, minnows, or, if those proved too expensive, pieces of dough. Where they could along the banks, the boys tied extra lines to trees that overhung the dark green water, using the branches as makeshift poles to troll for grays, the long-whiskered, spotted channel catfish that lurked near the banks. If one of your tree branches came to life and started thrashing, you knew you had a cat on the line. Since channel cats prefer to eat in the dark, the boys usually settled in for the long haul. Some nights they brought blankets and pillows and slept under the stars, just as Sweet was doing 60 miles away on a sorority roof. Other times they stayed up till dawn, reveling in feeling young and invincible as the sun's first rays colored the water. Always, they communicated through the language of boasts and jabs, Schartzer bragging about how many fish he intended to catch, while Henneberry, whose slow drawl sounded to many like a southern accent, announced each of his bites with great drama.
"Shark! I got one, and I'm playing with it over here! You know, he's going to take it here, going to go down with it!"
The fishing trips weren't a competition, at least not explicitly. But of course, on some level, they were, as everything was with Schartzer. So each boy kept an unspoken tally of the number and size of catfish caught, then stored the information for future reference. Once in a while, when the conversation did turn to baseball, it usually ended up on Sweet, for the boys shared a deep admiration for their coach. For Schartzer, Sweet provided a counterbalance to his own demanding father. For Henneberry, Sweet embodied the promise of a larger, wilder world. Neither boy could imagine playing baseball at Macon without him. Usually, special meetings of the Macon School Board weren't called until during the school year, when unexpected issues arose. Thus, it came as a surprise to the board members when word came that one was scheduled for September 3, 1970, the start of the semester. That evening, all the usual cars pulled into the Macon High parking lot. Presently, they were joined by one rarely seen at the school that late at night. At 7:30 p.m. in the small school library, new board president Bob Glass took roll call. Former president Merv Jacobs was there, as were Dick Snitker and Don Kraft, along with Neil Lentz, Scott Towson, and Roy Rausch. Joining the board, as always, were Bill McClard and Roger Britton. Also present, for the first time since being hired by Macon High, was, as the minutes recorded, Mr. Lynn Sweet, a teacher in the Macon schools. Glass stood up and announced that the purpose of the meeting was disciplinary, and the employee in question was Mr. Sweet. Then, for what felt like 15 or 20 minutes, various board members described what they believed to be Sweet's unbecoming conduct. First to speak was Rausch, a conservative man who, while a cousin of Brad Rausch's father, was not much of a baseball fan. He spoke of how Sweet drove around town in his Red Scout, a four-wheel drive Jeep that most considered outlandish. Rausch said it reflected poorly upon Macon High when the Scout was parked outside bars at all hours. Sweet's mop of hair was also a topic of conversation, as was his laissez-faire attitude with the students. Most troubling, however, was the way he'd handled the end of the baseball season the previous spring. Not collecting the uniforms was bad enough, but criticizing the administration could only be construed as willfully disrespectful. Throughout the proceedings, McClard likely didn't say much, but he didn't need to. Sweet knew who was behind the meeting. All summer, the baseball parents had continued to look for someone to blame for the disqualification, and Sweet suspected that McClard viewed him as the instigator. This, no doubt, only added to McLeod's lingering anger over countless slights, perceived and real, as well as his clear disapproval of the company Sweet kept. In particular, McLeod wasn't fond of Ernie Miller, Mark's dad. Ernie worked at the state employment office and could be a funny, charming man, but he turned dark when he drank. He wore a leather brace where his left hand had been, the result of a shotgun accident when he was young. But his right hand could inflict some serious damage. A hulking man at 6'2" and 240 pounds, he gained a reputation as the best fighter in Macon, and tough guys from neighboring towns sometimes showed up in the taverns hoping to take a crack at Ernie. Most left nursing a busted nose, wounded pride, or both. As much as McLeod disliked Miller, the feeling was mutual. And Sweet was pretty sure that if Ernie believed he could get away with it, he would have kicked McLeod's ass. Now, Sweet sat in his chair, incredulous. Finally given a chance to answer for himself, he stood up. "What's the charge here?" Sweet asked. "What have I done wrong?" And on it went for half an hour. Sweet alternately defending himself, listening to new charges, and cracking jokes at what he saw as the absurdity of the situation. If enjoying life was a crime, he was guilty. But how did that make him a bad teacher or coach? When the meeting was over, the minutes read as follows. Mr. Sweet talked with the board at length about the past and future status of his association with the Macon schools. The board, in turn, discussed with Mr. Sweet their reaction to his conduct and association with the school during past years. Upon conclusion of the discussion, Mr. Sweet retired from the meeting. With Sweet gone, the board went into its executive session, the off-the-record portion of the meeting where the real dirt went down. The topic? Whether or not to relieve the young English teacher of his duties. Meanwhile, Sweet jumped into the Red Scout that irritated Roy Roush so much and drove to Jack Stringer's. He needed some whiskey, and fast. After all, tomorrow was his wedding day. At noon the following day, the Friday of Labor Day weekend, Sweet left work early, still not sure if he'd have a job or not come Monday, but determined not to let it ruin his weekend. He picked up Jeannie in Decatur, where she was student teaching at Lakeview High School. And 2 hours later, the pair appeared in front of a judge in Charleston, Illinois. The bride wore a short, red, white, and blue sailor print dress, the groom a white shirt and black tie. At the end of the ceremony, Sweet kissed Jeannie, after which the two newlyweds began to walk away. They didn't get 15 feet before they heard a voice behind them. "Excuse me," the judge said. "That'll be $10. The couple spent their wedding night at the U.S. Grant Motel in Mattoon, the only honeymoon they could afford. The next morning, they arrived at Lynn's parents' house in Champaign. When Sweet's mother appeared at the door, her son held up his ring finger. "Hey, Mom, I'm married," Sweet announced. "Can we spend the weekend?" Lillian Sweet was elated, as she tended to be whenever her son was happy. In some ways, she was the opposite of Lynn's father. Emotional, outgoing, available. A lover of music and literature, she was smart and tough, and regretted to her last day that she didn't have the opportunity to further her education. Her father had 3 children, but only the money to send 2 to college. Lillian had the misfortune of being the only girl. She'd met Lynn's father one night in 1936 when he was hitchhiking through town on his way to an airbase. He moved on, but regularly wrote her long, eloquent letters. Later, he sent her books from overseas, including a thick copy of War and Peace with gilded edges. To the distress of Lillian's parents, who'd never approved of Lynn Sr., the couple married in 1938. Lynn was born 2 years later, his sister Libby 6 years after that. The family's life had been dictated by Lynn Sr.'s career. Since he was away for months and sometimes years at a time, it fell to Lillian to raise Lynn and his younger sister. The Sweets had little money, and each subsequent move promised a new life that never materialized as they hoped. The family bounced from Crewe, Virginia, to Newport News, from Hopewell, Arizona, to Yuma. For a while, they lived in a state park in Illinois. By the time they moved to Champaign, Lynn Jr. had experienced far more than most Midwest children his age.